Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's a big bonus year on Wall Street, the biggest in history. And at the end of a brutal year of bailout and economic pain, that is tough for a lot of Americans to swallow. Rugged. Let's think it through philosophically with one of America's top political philosophers, Michael Sandel. This hour on Point, Immanuel Kant, John Rawls, and Justice at bonus time with Michael Sandel. You can join the conversation. Has the economic crisis changed the way you think about justice? Do we need to revisit our underlying philosophy here? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now from Fort Myers, Florida, is Michael Sandel, political philosopher and professor at Harvard University. He teaches one of the school's most popular courses on justice. You may have caught some of it in his 12-part PBS series airing now. His new book is Justice, What's the Right Thing to Do? Michael Sandel, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be with you again.
It's great to have you, and particularly on this day when President Obama is sitting down today with lots of top bankers and Wall Street folks to talk about all kinds of things. People may have seen on 60 Minutes yesterday the president talking kind of rough on the Wall Street crowd. Fat cats who don't get it, he said yesterday. And you know from all the surveys and polls out there, there's a lot of emotion about this. But we wanted to kind of settle in on it philosophically with you, if we could, Michael, and if you'd be good enough to kind of lead us through a short course on how to think about these giant bonuses beyond the emotion, to really think through their significance, how we might understand them in terms of justice. How do you begin to look at $140 billion going out the door in Wall Street bonuses this year?
Well, it does raise a big question of justice. And the simplest definition of justice is giving people what they deserve. And I think the debate we're having and the outrage that we've seen over the bonuses and the bailouts has to do with a widespread sense that these bankers don't deserve these great bonuses. And much of the discussion has been focused on the fact that the taxpayer has subsidized, bailed out these banks and investment houses. But in a way, the debate about bonuses raises a broader issue of who deserves what that applies in good times as well as in bad times. Can it really be said that even in the good times, this is the more radical, thoroughgoing question of justice, even in the good times, is it fair, is it morally deserved that people who run investment houses and hedge funds make tens, hundreds of millions of dollars, while the average school teacher, let's say, makes what? It's about $42,000 a year. Is that fair? And there are two ways of answering that question of fairness. One is, well, if the free market produces the outcome, if no one is coerced, then whatever the free market produces, that distribution is fair. That's a libertarian, laissez-faire free market answer to the question, who deserves what? Another answer to the question says, well, whether that distribution is fair depends on the contribution of bankers and of teachers to the common good. And by that definition of justice, it's very hard to say that bankers deserve to make hundreds of times what school teachers do.
So you look at the bonuses going out now that are getting people so riled up, and it takes you right back to the good times. I mean, here we are. It's 2009. They're higher than ever. They're higher than their highest year previously in history, which was 2007. And interestingly, I mean, though the issue got raised about equity, it wasn't really a burning issue because times were good. You're looking back from these bonuses now to those times and saying, let's reconsider the whole formula.
Yes. In fact, it's we haven't had that broader debate really, though maybe this whole experience will open the way for that kind of broader debate. It was interesting when the bailout first took place. Some of the heads of the banks were brought before Congress and asked to account for their role in the financial meltdown. And some of them made an interesting argument. They said, look, we were hit by a financial tsunami. These were economic forces beyond our control, so we did everything we possibly could have done. These were the CEOs mm-hmm, of the Wall Street right. firms. Mm-hmm. These were forces beyond our control. That raises an interesting question. Suppose that they are right, or right to some degree, mm-hmm. that big economic forces determine the fate of Wall Street and stocks and the general direction of the economy. If that's true in the bad times, when there's a financial tsunami, what about when the sun is shining? What about during the good times? Would they agree, these CEOs, that those the great bounty that they collected in the 90s and early 2000s were also due to a great many economic forces that were beyond their control?
They might have to acknowledge those forces, but I don't think they'd want to draw a straight line. They'd rather say it was their genius, their brilliant, you know, management of money.
Well, here's an interesting thought experiment to test this idea. The ratio of CEO pay to the pay of the average worker at major the big American companies mm-hmm. is now about 350 to 1, which means that the CEO makes in a day roughly what the average worker makes in a year.
Okay.
Now, you could ask, here's a question of justice, is that fair? And the defenders of those big pay differentials say something like, well, these CEOs, they have talent, they have judgment, they have special skills, and they work very hard. That's the justification.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look back, let's look back at 1980. What was that ratio? Not 350 to 1, it was 42 to 1.
In the United States, for American CEOs.
In the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So would we say that CEOs today are eight times as hardworking and talented and smart as the CEOs in 1980? That would be hard to believe. So if that's implausible, mm-hmm. then it can't really be the case that the bounty that the market bestows upon CEOs of banks is simply or mainly due to the fact that they are very hardworking and very good at their jobs. It must have to do with moral contingencies, big economic forces, in this case having to do with globalization and the advent of the internet and global financial markets, all kinds of factors to do with the economy and technology that accounted for this huge run-up in the ratio of CEO pay to the average worker. Once you clear away, once you point out the morally arbitrary contingencies, it's very hard to claim that those who land on top morally deserve, through their own effort, striving, and talent, the huge bounty that markets happen to heap upon certain professions.
In certain countries, I mean, as you point out in your book, Justice, what do CEOs get in different countries as a multiple of the average worker is very, very different.
Right. The United States is far and away has the biggest multiple ratio. And in Europe and in Japan, the ratio is much smaller. And so it has to do with compensation practices. It has to do with all sorts of factors beyond the moral desert of the people who earn it. And if that's true, then we should have a public debate not only about compensation, because that, in a way, is the tip of the iceberg, but also about the tax system, how the tax system should treat the enormous gaps between rich and poor that have emerged in recent decades.
How do you think different of the great philosophers in history would hear the argument that you're making here? Who would nod along and say, Michael Sandel, you're on to something there, you've got your eye on the right ball, and which of the great philosophers would say, no, I don't know, you're intruding on individual freedom or you're forgetting about a person's ownership of their own selves, their own effort.
Right. Well, in terms of the pure free market idea of justice, that does say, look, we own our own labor and therefore we have a privileged right to the fruits of the exercise of our labor in a market economy. This idea goes in a way back to John Locke, the idea of self-possession, self-ownership. But even Locke thought there were certain unalienable rights to life, liberty, and property that we ourselves couldn't trade away. In recent years, libertarians have been the defense, have provided a philosophical defense for the pure free market idea of justice based on self-ownership and the idea that we have a right, a moral right, to keep whatever we earn in the market economy, that on the one hand. And then on the other hand, our more egalitarian thinkers in recent years, John Rawls has challenged the pure free market idea of justice. He says that justice should not depend on morally arbitrary factors. And so where you were born, what family you grew up in, what kind of education you had, what sorts of talents our society happens to value and reward, these are not the doing of you and me, of the banker, of the teacher. These are morally arbitrary factors that should not give rise to a moral right to keep everything we earn regardless of the effect on the common good. So John Rawls says we should think about justice by asking what principles of distribution we would accept if we didn't know what talents we had or what kind of family we grew up in, what kind of school we would have an opportunity to go to. And that would lead to a more egalitarian approach to the distribution of income and wealth that says only those inequalities are just that work to the advantage of the least well-off. That would be John Rawls's approach.
Of course, you could also go all the way back to Aristotle, where he talks about the common virtue and what encourages that and what may not. We'll look at all of that in the context of what's going on with bonuses in this country, our financial system, how we understand it, how we live within it. What's just? Michael Sandel is with us. His new book is Justice, What's the Right Thing to Do? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about bonuses, the American financial system, and what's just? Justice, with political philosopher Michael Sandel. His new book is Justice, What's the Right Thing to Do? You may have seen his 12-part PBS series playing on public television stations around the country. He joins us today from Fort Myers, Florida, but he teaches one of the most popular courses at Harvard University among undergraduates there, very eager to dive into questions of justice. In a 60 Minutes interview that aired yesterday, President Obama didn't use the word justice, but he certainly was channeling some national frustration with what's been going on with compensation of American bankers in pretty tough times, planning to give out this year very large bonuses.
The people on Wall Street still don't get it. They don't get it. They're still puzzled. Why is it that people are mad at the banks? Well, let's see. You know, you guys are drawing down $10, $20 million bonuses after America went through the worst economic year that it's gone through in decades. And you guys caused the problem. And we've got 10% unemployment. Why do you think people might be a little frustrated?
Michael Sandel, we've been in a very free market period for some decades now with a strong libertarian strain in it. But you must have seen, along with all the rest of us, as soon as you begin to question some of those sort of philosophical underpinnings, the taunt socialism is thrown out very, very quickly here. In philosophical terms, is there room between where we've been and where we might be that's not necessarily to do with socialism?
Well, I think there's a lot of room. In a way, we've experienced over the last three decades a period of market triumphalism, which began in the 80s with Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, but in many ways was consolidated and moderated by the Clinton and Blair years. And the central idea of the era of market triumphalism was that markets are the primary instrument for achieving the public good. And so the real question, I think, now in the aftermath of the financial meltdown is whether that fundamental idea will be called into question and whether we'll be able to have a broader debate not only about what's a fair distribution of income and wealth, that's very important, that's what we've just been discussing, but also about the common good and whether markets are useful instruments but perhaps very limited instruments for achieving the common good.
Let's begin to bring our listeners into this philosophical conversation. Middlefield, Connecticut, Larry is calling. Larry, you're on the air with Michael Sandel.
How are you, gentlemen?
Well.
first of all, I'm a libertarian, and I oppose the bailouts. But during the conversation, the author, we're talking about justice, and he talks about justice, and he talks about what's fair.
Mm-hmm.
Justice and fairness sometimes are two different ideologies. And I was wondering if he could go into, you know, does he consider them to be one, or are they separate?
It's a great question. Justice and fairness, are they the same thing, Michael?
Well, when we're talking about the distribution of the good things in life, and here, in this case, of income and wealth, one could add opportunities, rights, honors, offices. These are the things that distributive justice are about. Then the question of justice and the question of fairness are pretty closely aligned. I have a hunch that what Larry has in mind as a possible difference is the idea of freedom. Libertarians say that justice is fundamentally about freedom, not fairness, namely the right of people to choose for themselves what to do with the money they make, and for that matter, what to do with their own bodies and their own lives. And that would get into questions beyond the distribution of income and wealth, questions about whether the government violates our rights, as many libertarians would say, when it requires us to buckle up, mandatory seatbelt laws, mm-hmm. when it requires motorcycle riders to wear helmets, whether they want to or not. So in many ways, the libertarian approach to justice says the fundamental value is freedom and respect for the right of each person to choose for himself or herself. And so if we were to pursue that line with Larry or other libertarians, we would have to get into cases about paternalism and should the government ever try to legislate in ways that protect people from themselves.
But can the just ever be unfair? Larry's kind of saying, well, it may not seem fair, but it's right. You know, they did the work. They earned the money. It's theirs. It may not seem fair, but it's just.
Well, if the libertarian theory of justice were true, if it were defensible, and if it were the case that the exercise of freedom and respecting people's freedom were the highest value, freedom understood as the ability to keep what you make in the market, then there would be actually no basis for complaining that bankers making huge amounts of money and school teachers relatively less is unfair. If you think the only standard of justice is what people make through the free exercise of their talents in a market economy. Now, that idea is subject to many familiar objections,
mm-hmm.
the first of which is that do people really make free choices if some people have very limited life circumstances? The jobs open to them may be very, very few. How free really is that choice? That would be one line of argument that an egalitarian might raise against a defender of the free market libertarian view.
You raised three sort of strains or ways of approaching, thinking about the distribution of goods in a society philosophically. But
yes.
Freedom is only one of them. You also
yes.
Cite welfare and virtue. Speak to those others. In our free market heyday, we've been very focused on freedom. But what about welfare and virtue? What do those refer to? What philosophers support those as other ways?
The welfare tradition is basically the utilitarian approach to justice. The idea going back to Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill that says the right thing to do, the just thing to do, whether in personal morality or in making laws, is whatever will bring about the greatest happiness for the greatest number of people. And so to bring that back to our discussion about the market, we often hear the argument for big bonuses or for Wall Street bankers saying, well, we will not be able to attract the best talent unless we provide the incentive
mm-hmm.
of a big bonus.
Mm-hmm.
The incentive argument is a utilitarian argument. The system won't work as well, and therefore the financial system will not work as well. The argument for the bailouts, in fact, was that if we don't do these bailouts, then the whole economy will melt down and everyone will suffer. That is a utilitarian argument.
So it was a greater good, utilitarian argument.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the virtue argument derives from Aristotle, the idea that justice is a matter of recognizing and rewarding virtue and promoting the common good. This has to do, Aristotle says, justice has to do with honoring and recognizing virtue and promoting civic virtue and the common good. To tie that back into the discussion we've been having about the bankers, quite apart from whether you think it's unfair that they are making so much money, there is another worry about what the experience of market triumphalism over the last three decades, and that is that we have come to honor and accord great social prestige to people who are involved in iBanking or in Wall Street, and we have neglected the value and the contribution to the common good of people, say, like school teachers or firefighters, who do not receive huge rewards. So it isn't just the amount of money and the unequal amount of money that people make. It's also the social recognition and the honor that goes with it.
So what would Aristotle say is the problem with that?
Well, he would say, is holding up... Well, here, let me give you a very concrete example. Among my students, among college students, generally, the idea until just recently, you would ask them, what do you want to do? A lot of them would say, I want to go into iBanking. And then you would say, well,
investment banking, yeah.
Investment banking. And you'd say, okay, why do you want to do that? What do they do? And many times the students would say, I haven't any idea what they do. Now, why would they want to go in? Well, they know that there's a lot of money to be made, but there is also a kind of social prestige, a sense that this is the highest form of recognition. So Aristotle would say that we should, that to answer to what people deserve, we must first have a shared conception of what virtues, what pursuits, what contributions to the common good are worthy of holding up, of admiring. So justice for Aristotle is a matter of honor and recognition. What virtues are worthy of honor and recognition by the political community? And he would say, I think, that a political community that valorizes the ability to move money around above other virtues, the ability to contribute well to public deliberation, for example, or to civic education. There is something flawed about the conception of the good life that system of honoring and valorizing reflects.
But when you say that, you know, people are immediately going to worry about, well, who's going to decide what's virtuous? You had a debate, a conversation when your book came out with Peggy Noonan and Lonnie Guinier and Neil Ferguson, the historian. And I'm reading here a summary of that, and where he responds to this point about virtue. This is the historian Ferguson saying, I'm not sure you're ever going to get me to be enthusiastic about virtue. He said, I just see Robespierre every time you use that word, the embodiment of Republican virtue, sending people to the guillotine.
Right. And there is a big question here about whether to think about justice and to think about rights. We can do that while setting aside our competing conceptions of the good life, of what's worthy of admiration, of what virtues we as a society should try to cultivate and to promote. And this debate is in many ways a debate between modern or liberal political philosophy from Immanuel Kant up through John Rawls, on the one hand, which says that government and justice and rights should be neutral with respect to substantive conceptions of the good life, and an older tradition, going back to Aristotle, which says that when we debate about justice and rights and the distribution of the good things in life, we can't separate those questions from some underlying idea about what the good life is, about what virtue is, about what values are worth promoting, teaching our children, holding up as exemplary. And in that debate between, say, Kant and Rawls on the one hand and Aristotle on the other, toward the end of the book, I lean toward the Aristotelian idea that ultimately debates about justice can't be separated from conceptions of the good life.
But isn't that what makes the market so appealing in a way as arbiter? Because if you say, well, the market will sort it out, then it's hands-free. You don't have to judge. You don't have the burden of judging what's virtuous.
Exactly. This, I think, is the the strongest part of the appeal of a market-based idea of justice and distribution. It seems, at least, that markets are non-judgmental. They take our preferences, our consumer preferences, as they come, and they satisfy them or fail to satisfy them depending on our resources, but they don't judge those preferences. Now, so that's part of the appeal of markets, and there is something terribly liberating in the idea that we can resolve these questions in a non-judgmental way. After all, we disagree about these substantive moral conceptions and ideas of virtue. So there's something very appealing. But what I would suggest is that way of thinking about justice, divorced from conceptions of the good life, does not provide a plausible basis of justice. Justice is unavoidably judgmental, whether we're arguing about bailouts or health care or the ethics of torture or affirmative action or same-sex marriage. We can't decide those questions in a way that is neutral with respect to the underlying moral and even sometimes religious questions that people bring to bear in public life.
Let's get a call from West Boylston, Massachusetts, and Katie. Katie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks very much for my call. I'm going to take a stab at defending bankers.
All right, let's hear it.
I mean, if you're going to get into this as justice, are you also going to get into professional athletes who play a game for a living?
And make many millions.
$189 million.
Yeah.
And there's far more professional athletes than there are bankers, and as much as, or if not more, social prestige. None of those athletes, for example, actually build anything. If you come to a banker and you say, I'm Google, I'm two guys out of college, and I want to raise some money because I have a great idea that's actually going to help other people become employed.
Right.
And they go ahead and, for a set fee, a percentage of how much they want to raise, that's what the bankers earn. I think when you have a regulatory structure, which I agree with, otherwise you have water, which is like money, that just flows and it gets through any hole or whatever that it can exploit. So maybe there needs to be more structure here. But I think lumping all of this injustice on a particular sector really doesn't do anything. I mean, if you can at least see that banking in some regards helps other people build their own American dreams and American companies.
Yeah, Katie, I hate to dump it all on bankers. I agree, Katie, but I think the issue was more the level of compensation for that valuable work that bankers do.
Okay, well,
what about
let's
that?
Talk about that a little bit. Do you think that Katie Couric or Charlie Gibson reading from a teleprompter deserve $12 or $14 million a year? I mean, yeah, Aristotle was a teacher, right? There are professors at HBS who earn $400,000 a year. I have some familiarity with this.
Yeah.
Who teach one course, not one per semester, one course a year.
Right.
Is that fair?
Great questions. Philosopher, Professor Sandel, what do you say to Katie? There's a useful job being done, she says here. And, hey, A-Rod makes a ton of money. Is he more valuable than a banker?
Well, that's a harder call for me once we get into A-Rod. So I would cast a skeptical eye on all of the cases that Katie raised. But at listening closely to what Katie's saying, it seems to me that that Katie is not rejecting the idea that we can judge and argue about what a fair level of compensation is. She was simply suggesting that we should perhaps be more appreciative of the contribution of bankers to the common good. But so long as the debate is about contribution to the common good, notice it's no longer about the idea that we have a moral right to keep whatever the market dispenses. And that holds true whether we're talking about A-Rod or whether we're talking about bankers or people who make a lot of money as anchors reading the news.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about bonuses, the American financial system, and what's justice, with political philosopher Michael Sandel. Justice, What's the Right Thing to Do is the name of his new book. You may have seen his PBS series. He has one of the most popular classes at Harvard for young minds really wanting to explore what is justice. And maybe our economic circumstances in this country have had you thinking about the same question lately. Have we thought enough about justice in this country, or just about markets and who can make what? Or is that the right measure of all things in America. Michael Sandel joins us today from Fort Myers, Florida. We've got a lot of callers here, Waterbury, Connecticut, and Tony. Tony, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
As I listen to you guys, I'm really astonished. With what scale would you use to measure me against my brother for justice, who makes three times what I make? We oftentimes had the same high school teachers. We grew up in the same house, in the same town. And it comes down to, at the end, he dug in harder than I did. He worked harder than I did. And he deserves to make three times what I make. And I'm thrilled for him. But who are you to decide what justice to balance those scales? Or anybody else? It comes down to people, personal wants, personal drives, personal desires.
Tony, I totally get it. And
take money from one and give it to another who may not be entitled to that because they just have not worked for it is outrageous to me.
I hear you absolutely, and I'll take it to the philosopher professor with us, but let me ask you, what if he made, 1,000 times what you make or 10,000 times? Would it make any difference?
No.
Okay.
Could I ask Tony a question?
Yeah.
Tony, could I ask you this? Do you think, put aside taking from your brother and giving it to you, do you think that the two of you should pay the same tax rate or different tax rates?
I don't know. You didn't answer my question. What scale are you going to use to balance his success against mine due to his extra drive and my lack of it? What scale do you use for justice? Answer my question first.
Okay, who's going to judge? Okay, hang on. Good. Michael Sandel.
Okay, well, Tony is of the view that his brother worked hard and so deserves to make three times what he did because he didn't work as hard. Fair enough. But the question is, when it comes to financing public purposes, whether it's healthcare or roads or schools, is the moral desert of those who land on top, whether through their own efforts or through good fortune, whatever the case may be, is the moral, do they have a claim to their earnings so powerful that it would be wrong to tax them to pay for the health care or for the education of those less successful than they? That's the real issue. Still have Tony?
No, I don't think we do. But let me ask you. Tony's question is, if you're not going to let the market sort it out, who is? How are you going to decide? I mean, if it's, you know, who will judge? If it's not markets sort of coolly determining this, how do you get to justice?
Well, who will judge? We as a democratic society, as a democratic community will judge, which is why we have these debates all the time, which is why we have campaigns and elections, which why we have all these arguments on the floor of the Senate over what is a fair way to finance the health care bill. In the House, the House version, for example, provides that a good portion of the health care would be financed by a surtax on the very wealthy. That represents a judgment, a democratic judgment, at least by the House. In the Senate, they're not so keen on that way of financing it. They have other ways. But the short answer, what besides the market, who else decides? We collectively decide as a democracy, which when we enact the tax laws, when we enact the way of financing public services, whether they be schools or health care or national defense, and really, at the heart of so many of our arguments, of our democratic deliberation, are precisely these questions of justice, of who deserves what. But the question of whether Tony's brother morally has a claim in the extra earnings he made does go a long way toward informing this question, whether the affluent should be taxed at a higher rate, whether we should abolish the inheritance tax or keep it. All of these debates about financing public services and public goods really rest on the question, what is the moral claim that the successful have to the bounty that the market has given them? And we heard during the period of market triumphalism, it's your money. You deserve it. You deserve to keep it. And it's really that question, that fundamental question of moral desert, that is very much at stake in competing conceptions of justice.
Tony wouldn't be alone, though, in a conclave of philosophers across the ages in his saying, well, you know, no one can decide for me. Don't take away my freedom here.
Right. The idea, there is an idea of justice, and it's broadly speaking the libertarian idea of justice that says those who succeed in financial terms and in other terms are morally entitled to their success because it reflects their doing, their efforts, their virtues, their strengths. And that, I think, underlies something like Tony's view. But John Rawls and other egalitarian philosophers would challenge that, saying, the skills you use to get ahead, are they all your doing? Are you indebted for having gone to a certain school, having had certain educational opportunities? And by the way, the skills that are in such demand, you know, we were talking about A-Rod.
Mm-hmm.
A-Rod makes all of that money. He's fortunate that we in our society so love baseball that we are willing to have a system that pays some baseball players $25 million. It wasn't always thus. Does A-Rod have a right to live in a society that prizes baseball, his great skills, to the extent we happen to do? Or is that his good luck?
Tony, I hear you out there. Because I'm sure he's still thinking, I was raised in the same family. I went to the same school. Who are you to say that my brother doesn't deserve it if he found it? Let's get another perspective here. Michael, Nashville, Tennessee. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Real quick, first, I think draw the comparison with sports athletes, sports celebrities, and what they demand is not a fair comparison to what you're talking about with the investment bankers. First of all, you've got people that have an incredible lobby that are able to go in and help write this legislation that favors them well above what we want to talk about in Main Street. I'm a small business owner, and I employ 10 people.
Mm-hmm.
And I see how if you're in an economic development situation, let's say the 80% of all new jobs are created by firms with 50 people or less.
Yes.
But yet you've got legislation that is written, or for the most part, I think we can all agree on this, that it's written by the corporations, the Fortune, let's say Fortune 200, that are hiring, let's say, 15% of the people. So we've got these rules that favor these organizations that I don't think – there is definitely an inequity there that you're not having let's say, the sports.
So kind of a stacked deck for those at the top of the system, you're saying?
Oh, well, most definitely. I mean, when you've got a system that's rigged up for short selling, I mean, how does short selling someone's stock – I don't think it's right. Let's look at the people who lobbied to have the stocks are dropping, the stop drop that they had, the uptick rule was removed 2 years ago. And a lot of people knew that was going to just bring this incredible volatility. But yet nobody wants to look at who was making the moves to put those things in place.
So, but power accrues to those with a lot of wealth there, and maybe that comes back to underwrite their earnings. Maybe that's a distinction between a powerful Wall Street community and professional baseball players, Michael Sandel.
I think Michael raises a very good point. We've been talking, and the public debate has been framed as a debate about the compensation of these bankers and whether the government should somehow rein it in a little bit. And by the way, the reining in is actually temporary because it depends on the banks being recipients of TARP funds and so on. But what Michael draws our attention to, I think, is an equally important, if not more important, aspect of this, which is not compensation, but regulation. The whole crisis came about in large part because there had been deregulation, and now the Obama administration has proposed ways means of financial regulation that would prevent this happening again. And the president has been complaining, rightly, that these banks are now out there spending millions of dollars lobbying against regulations that would prevent this happening again. The only disagreement. The only question I would raise about that complaint of President Obama is, back when they were debating what to do in response to the financial crisis, there was a debate over whether to give the TARP bailout in effect, mm-hmm. or whether to exert a greater degree of public control and accountability. The big N-word, nationalization, was one the administration didn't want to countenance. But what about putting public representatives on the boards of directors of companies that essentially were owned in large part by taxpayers, at least in proportion to the public stake? If that had been done, those boards of directors could instruct management not to lobby against regulatory reform in the public interest. So I'm not quite sure the taxpayer, that we as taxpayers got our money's worth when it came to influencing the lobbying efforts of these banks with respect to the regulations. And I think Michael's question really points to the fact that this should not only be a debate about compensation, but also about reforming the regulation of the financial system and the economic forces that play a part in setting those regulations.
Let's go to Martin in Williamsburg, Virginia. Martin, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you. I would like to just bring this together in terms of whether you have control from the top to try to control morality or whether you have moral individuals, neither socialism, control from the top, libertarianism, none of these things work unless you have a morality in the society.
Mm-hmm.
And libertarianism is freedom, and it's quite consistent with the Christian idea of freedom, and do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And everybody has a talent. And in a true libertarianism society, no one has a right to co-opt another person's talent for his selfish use. And the underlying principle, this was backed up, that the primary thing in the Bible is the workers in the vineyard, where the parable is that the people who got hired late in the day got paid the same as the people that signed on early.
Mm-hmm.
And they were resentful and bitter,
right.
And they went to the guy and they said, "You didn't do right." He said, "Did you agree to work for that wage this morning?" And they said, "Yes, we did." And he said, "Well, then, what right do you have to tell me I can't pay these people more if I want to later in the day?"
So, Martin, let me ask you.
In other words, it is a justice is a wage that motivates people. And if you tell third world workers that you have to have union wages, then they don't have a job. They're motivated at a lower wage.
Do you think the mega bonuses show that something's out of whack or not, then, Martin?
Excuse me?
Do you think the very big bonuses and bonus pools show that something's out of whack in our country or not?
Well, do I think it's out of whack? I think there's no reason that you can't find somebody to do a lot of these jobs for a much lower wage, but that's not for us. That's not for a central government. It's not to be achieved by force. It's something that the companies themselves, through a just market system, should do. And when you have a society that thinks that whoever has the power gets to do what he wants, this is underlying morality in the society. And this affects both the upper classes and the lower classes.
Yeah, you want that just market system. And just getting that may be part of the issue here. Let me get one more call. Giovanni, North Haven, Connecticut. Martin, thank you. Giovanni, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a brief point and to go back to the banking industry. I was born in Switzerland with a large banking industry with probably in the 80s the same kind of problem we have now. I think the issue is not the amount of bonus that these people are going to receive and the way they're going to receive it. It's just that they are lobbying with the government or the power in charge to be free to act in whatever the market's going to be. And they've been doing that for centuries in the United States. It started with the railroad. And unfortunately, the access of the wealthy through the government lobbying than they've been doing for centuries almost is now denying social justice to other people. It's not that the government wants to inflict force and restriction to the banking industry, but it has to act because the banking industry is destroying the manufacturing and the middle class in this country. If we don't act in one way or the other, then, you know, the consequences socially are going to be terrible.
Giovanni, our time is so short. Let me take it to Michael Sandel. We've just got a minute, Michael. Is there room in the political tradition for this country for the philosophical conversation that you're in here and that Giovanni joins there?
Well, I think so. I hope so. If you look back over the period of market triumphalism the past three decades, essentially what that has enshrined is the idea that our identity as consumers with desires and preferences in the market are primary. And that is the non-judgmental appeal of deciding distribution by markets. But what that leaves out of account, and this takes us back to the tradition of civic virtue and the common good, going back to Aristotle, is that we aren't only consumers. We are also citizens. And that means that we have certain conceptions of the good life, of the virtues, civic virtues worthy of honor and recognition that we want to promote in our children and in our fellow citizens. And that's what democratic deliberation is about. Decide not just accepting the results of that the market happens to dispense, but deliberating as citizens, which involves justice and I think also the meaning of the good life.
Michael Sandel, author of Justice, What's the Right Thing to Do, political philosopher at Harvard. It's always great to have you on board for a short course. It gets us thinking. We're grateful for it. Thank you for joining us today, Professor.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us as well. Plenty to think about right there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.